Time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots to talk about, including a bad bug in Microsoft's internet browser, a zero day that's been exposed already, a mess up in Intel's chip that's been a problem for almost a decade, and it is a big security flaw, and a lot of more stuff like that. It's just, you know, it's a nightmare. But we'll talk about all of it and how to protect yourself next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 610, recorded May 2nd, 2017. Intel's mismanagement engine. Security Now is brought to you by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Sonic, Twit's 10-gigabit fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your privacy and security online with this guy right here, Steve Gibson, the man in charge, GRC.com, and our security guru since 2005. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again for episode 610.
Wow.
At the beginning of May. And in fact, it was interesting that this that our main topic occurred on May 1st, because this is truly May Day for Intel.
Oh, boy.
The title of today's podcast is Intel's Mismanagement Engine. So we're going to discuss the long-expected remote vulnerability in Intel's super secret motherboard management engine technology. Also, there was a paper given at a European security conference, an IEEE conference, where five researchers from, I think it was the U of Michigan, I've got it in my notes, took a look at something no one had looked at closely before, and what they found was worrisome. And that's exploitable open ports in Android apps.
Oh.
We have another instance of an IoT device blowing a suspect's BS timeline. And you can just imagine when you the details of this are just so screwy. I'm sure when the police came out to investigate, they were like looking at each other going, oh, come on. We're supposed to believe this. There are some newly discovered problems in the widespread ghost script interpreter. Yet another way for ISPs to see where we go online. Another one that escaped my overall summary. So I wanted to mention that. There's a new bad problem in the Edge browser, which is very worrisome and was disclosed irresponsibly by an Argentinian researcher, for which there's no fix, and there are proof of concept exploits that allows, well, we'll get to that, bad. Chrome is changing their certificate policy, which is interesting. There's a very large and suspiciously well-designed new botnet growing in size that's being called a vigilante botnet. An interesting proposed solution to smartphone distracted driving, the emergence of ransomware as a service, and of course we have to talk briefly at least about the concerning reversal by this new administration on the previous administration's position on net neutrality. And this is worth rallying all of our listeners and, you know, everyone within reach as we approach the time for public opinion later this month after May 18th, because it's back on the chopping block again. There's an intriguing new service from Cloudflare for protecting IoT devices that we need to talk about and, of course, remind our listeners that they are a sponsor of the TWiT network. There's, of course, then the ongoing controversy over the Symantec certificate misissuance and what the browser should do to deal with it. And as if that wasn't enough, we have some fun errata, some miscellany, and then a little bit of closing the loop feedback from our terrific listeners. So, yes, 610 and going strong.
Well, we're going to take a break, and we will get to those fabulous subjects in this little bit. Our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. If you're in the IT business or you have a hankering to get into the IT business, you've got to know about IT Pro TV. The easiest way to prepare and learn and take the tests to get the certs to get you a great job and then to keep the skills up so you can keep that great job. IT Pro TV is an easy and entertaining approach to IT training that's kind of based on what we did. In fact, they freely admitted, Tim and Don, the founders, saw what we were doing and said, you know, we ought to do that with IT training. And now they've got 5 studios. They've got continual streams going on 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, over 2,000 hours of content. They're making 125 new hours every single week. They are on fire. And by the way, couldn't be easier to watch IT Pro TV because they've got apps for Chromecast, Roku, Fire TV, Apple TV, PC. So you put it up on your big screen. You can have it running all day. You can get on the road. You can listen on your phone. You can watch on your tablet or your computer. Courses include everything having to do with IT, from private cloud, MCSA Server 2016. Programmers you'll love, and scientists, Intro to NumPy, the Python numeric library used by scientists and statisticians everywhere. Wow, they're getting to some interesting areas. Coming up, Apple Certified Support Professional, CompTIA's Security Plus. They update that regularly. ITIL, Planning, Protection, and Optimization. So there's courses on business. There's courses on Six Sigma. There's courses on IT. Every one of them has a written transcript, just like Steve does with our show. So you could follow from start to finish. Some people like to see it on a page. But you can also search and find and jump to the part of the video you need. If you get the premium account, then you have the virtual machine labs. You don't need to have a Windows machine or a server. You can do it all in an HTML5 browser. You also get the practice exam. So if you're preparing for the cert, you really want to get the premium account. Those Transcender practice exams are worth $109 just by themselves, and they really help. IT Pro TV is growing like crazy. New enterprise clients include L.L. Bean, Meridian Health Services, Tech Data, Avnet, Phillips 66, Disney, and the ABC Television Group. Take advantage of their low monthly price, their no-hassle cancellation policy. That's because if you get the cert, a lot of people say, well, I'm done, but I bet you will want to keep it because you got to keep those skills up, and there's always something new to learn at IT Pro TV. So they have 2 new membership plans now. They have a standard membership level, which gives you access to all the live and recorded content, and that's great if you just want to keep it up or review it or just have something really geeky running on your TV. The premium membership includes all the video content, access to the virtual labs, the Q&A forums, the Transcender practice exams. The premium membership is actually really affordable when you apply our SecurityNow offer. The cost is normally $85.70 a month or $857 a year. You get 2 months free. But if you want to try it and get a 30% off discount, go to itpro.tv/security now. itpro.tv/security now. Use the code SN30. You'll get a 7-day trial so you can see everything. You'll get 30% off the monthly membership. It's a great deal. itpro.tv/security now. The offer code is SN30. They are just growing like crazy. I'm not surprised because it's a great field to get into, and they have the easiest way to learn. If you like what we do here on TWiT, you'll love IT Pro TV. On with the show, Stephen.
So I forgot to mention that we do have about a 2-minute audio clip to play. It's wonderful. Right. Following on from last week's very popular Turbo and Tabulator. However, whereas that one was a bunch of mumbo jumbo gobbledygook, this is actually completely mathematically correct, but wonderfully obtuse. Anyway, it's Missile Guidance Explained, and it's just audio, so there's no visual works in the podcast. There's another one that I just tweeted out it's more like the Turbo and Tabulator that involves the Muppets Cookie Monster, which is, unfortunately, it's completely visual, but it is just hysterically funny. I had no idea the Cookie Monster could be so expressive. Anyway, but that's not what we're going to show. I put it in the show notes and I tweeted it because you can also just Google Muppets Analytical Computer and you'll find it on YouTube. But the third link from the bottom of the second page, from the second to the last page, the Missile Guidance Explained, is just 2 minutes of audio that we will play when we get to it. But I wanted to give you a heads up. So our picture of the week, it had been in my queue. I have a backlog of pictures of the week and nothing jumped out. So I pulled this one from the Security Now backlog, which I thought was interesting. And it's apropos a story that we'll be getting to about the open ports, which is it's noting that this shows a graph of four different OSs, Android, Windows, iOS, and OS 10, from March of 2012 through March of 2017. So essentially a month ago. So 5 years, during which time the percentage of Windows OS drops from, it looks a little higher than 80, down to 37.91%. But during the same time, Android moves up from something that looks like around 4% up to 37.93. In other words, higher than Windows, more Android than Windows. And during this same time, iOS sort of putters along, slowly growing from, it looks like, a little more than Android, but now way behind. It drifts. It maybe goes up from like 5% up to around maybe 12 or 13. And OS 10 is pretty much floats around below 10 and dropping down just a little bit. But anyway, just sort of interesting that as this graph demonstrates, Android is now the, quote, the most popular, at least in terms of instances, in the world. I'm not sure I would call that popularity, but in terms of, you know, count, since so many devices are Android-based, but that's, you know, significant. And, of course, it means that the security of Android, as we know, is important. Okay, so this week's top story, I titled it A True Mayday for Intel. About a year ago, I looked back through the transcripts backlog, and I couldn't find the specific podcast where we discussed this in depth. But because we've discussed it many times, we've touched on it many times, and that's the so-called Intel Management Engine, which exists in a number of different forms. There's something called IAM, which is Intel Active Management, SBT, which is Small Business Technology, and ISM, which is Intel Standard Manageability. It's been around since like 2008 with the, and I had it written down, I don't see it. Is it the Kalem or I can't remember which processor architecture. Yes, that's the one.
Nehalem, yeah.
From them through Kaby Lake, so like up through just now. And the ME has had different versions, this Intel Management Engine, but versions from V6 through 11.6, which is current, are the area of concern. The problem, and as we discussed it before, is that this cannot be turned off. There's no way to disable it. You can't turn it off in the BIOS. There's that you can enable additional features, but the baseline set of features, just there's just no getting around it. It's a separate ARC processor that actually runs in one of the Intel one of the Intel chipset components that surrounds the main Intel processor that does all the memory management and I/O glue and slot management and so forth, providing USB and PCI functions and, you know, BIOS and all of that. It's always running. Intel has gone to tremendous lengths to keep it a secret. So it's not open. It's never been subject to scrutiny. People have been for years worried about it and chipping away at it. But as we discussed previously at length, you know, Intel did it, like used every trick in the book to hide what this is. And that alone is a concern. The idea that there is something in all motherboards for the last 9 years, from 2008 on, which is outside of all non-Intel scrutiny. The protocol is not documented. It's available under NDA and has been licensed to like three companies. Unfortunately, one of them is Symantec. Let's hope they can do a better job with that than they have with certificate issuance. So there are a few companies that provide enterprise access functionality that allow enterprises to manage their deployed machines throughout the enterprise. So not just servers, but laptops, desktops, tablets, anything essentially with an Intel chipset for nearly the past decade. And in fact, our listeners will remember that I was pulling my hair out for a couple of weeks. I was bringing up a new Intel-based 2U server about a year ago, and it was causing over at the level 3 data center. And I was getting these IP address conflicts. There was an ARP storm, and interfaces were fighting each other, and nothing I could do. I couldn't turn it off. I couldn't figure out what was going on. Finally, because these machines have multiple LAN interfaces, when I moved it from LAN 1 to LAN 2, that is away from the primary NIC, all of that went away. And I remember when we were discussing all this at the time, verifying that only the primary NIC on multi-NIC motherboards has this IME interface, and that what anyone could do would be to switch to a secondary or tertiary, anything but the primary NIC, and you would be okay. Because there's otherwise no way to turn this off. Well, the other shoe has dropped, and we now have a confirmed exploit. I mean, this is what everybody was worried about, and this is as bad as it gets. Because unlike OS, current versions of OSs themselves, and to an even greater degree, browsers, and to some degree even apps, the motherboard BIOS, while there may be patches available, there isn't an auto-patching mechanism. And even though only enterprises really need or use this, this is the conundrum, is it's on and cannot be disabled through any means. So, and I know while I was putting all this together, I dug into the background thinking, you know, is there a scanner? Is there some way we could check? The problem is, this is the problem with anything that is secret and proprietary and rigorously undocumented, is Nobody knows anything about this, except we now have a confirmed exploit. I found one site where some guy for years has been pounding on Intel, telling them this is a problem, and they've apparently just been ignoring him.
That's what's really frustrating, is that this has been known.
Yes.
For years.
Yes.
That's really frustrating.
And Intel's just, oh, that's not a problem. That's not a problem. So suddenly it's May Day. They have issued just yesterday, on May 1st, 2017, patches for all of their firmware for all of these motherboards. And while that's the good news, the problem is there are all, I mean, like I've got, I just checked my Lenovo X1 Carbon. It's got it and it's in there and it's running and I don't want it. But, you know, so it'll be one, as soon as I'm through with the podcast, I will see about whether, and I'll talk about it next week, what I find. Then I'll check GRC Security Now news group, because I'm sure that the people there will be interested in finding out whether there are firmware updates for their systems.
How could you patch this? Because isn't this in hardware? I mean,
no, it is. I mean, it's deep firmware is probably the way to describe it. So there are versions, and they do have patches, but there is no, and an enterprise could deploy these patches. But just so people understand, this is a rootkit. That's the best way to describe it. From my notes, I wrote, recent Intel x86 processors implement a secret, powerful control mechanism that runs on a separate chip that no one is allowed to audit or examine. When these are eventually compromised, they'll expose all affected systems to nearly unkillable, undetectable rootkit attacks. And the guy I'm quoting said, I've made it my mission to open up this system and make free open replacements before it's too late. And that's what we talked about this last year. There is a project to replace this with publicly available open source solution. This guy goes on, the Intel Management Engine is a subsystem composed of a special 32-bit ARC microprocessor that's physically located inside the chipset. It's an extra general-purpose computer running a firmware blob that is sold as a management system for big enterprise deployments. When you purchase your system with a main board and Intel x86 CPU, that is to say with an Intel chipset, you are also buying this hardware add-on, an extra computer that controls the main CPU. This extra computer runs completely out of band with the main x86 CPU, meaning that it can function totally independently even when your main CPU is in a low power state like S3, suspend. On some chipsets, the firmware running on the ME implements a system called Intel's Active Management Technology. This is entirely transparent to the operating system, which means this extra computer can do its job regardless of which operating system is installed. So it doesn't mean Windows. It could be Linux. It could be, you know, or like no OS if it's just sitting there waiting to be deployed. But it gets worse. The purpose of AMT is to provide a way to manage computers remotely. This is similar to an older system called Intelligent Platform Management Interface, IPMI, but this is more powerful than that. To achieve this task, the ME is capable of accessing any memory region without the main x86 CPU knowing about the existence of these accesses. I mean, it is a classic hardware backdoor. It also runs a TCP/IP server on your network interface, and packets entering and leaving your machine on certain ports bypass any firewall running on your system. This cannot be blocked by anything that you do running on top of it. While AMT can be great value add, it has several troubling disadvantages. ME is classified by security researchers, and this is what we talked about at the time, as Ring -3. You know, it's, you know, normal apps run at +3. Ring 0 is the OS. Well, this is way beneath the OS.
I didn't even know there was a ring, negative ring.
Ring -3. Rings of security, he writes, can be defined as layers of security that affect particular parts of a system, with a smaller ring number corresponding to an area closer to the hardware. For example, Ring 3 threats are defined as security threats that manifest in user space mode. Ring 0 threats occur in kernel level. Ring -1 threats occur in a hypervisor level. One level lower than the kernel, Ring -2 threats occur in a special CPU called SMM. That's system management mode, a special mode that Intel CPUs can be put into that runs a separately defined chunk of code. And if attackers can modify the SMM code and trigger the mode, they can get arbitrary execution of code on the CPU. But that's the main CPU. And this is -3, even below that. So, okay, so Intel rates this, their own problem, as critical remotely exploitable. I would love to know what external vulnerability this represents, but this is part of the problem. The information is so blacked out that I could find nothing about how to scan for it, how to detect it, anything. But here's the concern, is that systems will not update themselves. Unlike browsers and OSs and many apps, the BIOS doesn't. You normally need to go get it. Now, people like Lenovo, who have tried to integrate system management, controversial as it is, I would imagine that if you are using the Lenovo, keep your system up to date. I know that it does BIOS updates. I've been a long time ThinkPad and then a Lenovo user. I imagine that they could use that mechanism to push that out. But if you've just got, in the last nearly a decade, any Intel system that has this IME, the Intel Management Engine technology in it, then we don't really have a way of gauging. I don't want to run around hair on fire, screaming that the sky is falling.
There's mitigation. If you don't use the built-in network, but use your own network card, you're safe, right?
Correct. Yes.
If you it has to be these managed computers. It's in every Intel chip, but it was my sense it wasn't in the management engine wasn't enabled unless you have a managed system.
No, that's not correct. It's absolutely enabled. One thing you can do on Windows machines, if you browse through your list of services, and I did this on my Win7 X1, and there it was, Intel Management Engine, a service running. And that's the other problem, is that this is also vulnerable to local exploit, not just remote exploit.
So Intel says you have to have vPro technology for this, which is not all Intel chips.
Correct. And good. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yes, that is right. Wikipedia's page has already been updated. It was updated immediately to be current about this. They write, currently AMT is available in desktops, servers, ultrabooks, tablets, and laptops with Intel Core vPro processor family, including Intel Core i3, i5, i7, and the Xeons.
But that vPro was sold as an enterprise system. So, I mean, I'm sure it's on your ThinkPad X1 Carbon because that's an enterprise computer. But I bet you a lot of – I mean, I wouldn't assume – for instance, I have a Mac with an Inhalem processor. I would assume, or actually with a Xeon as well, I would assume it's not enabled there because those are not vPro systems.
Well, okay, so we probably need to not use the word enable. If it's present. If it's present, it's on because we can't turn it off, unfortunately. Right. So maybe it's just not there. I've got a bunch of links at the bottom of this about there is something you can Google Intel Management Engine Verification Utility. I found that.
There you go.
It's dated 2010, and Intel's page says it supports XP through Win 7. I'm sure it runs on Win 10 because Win 10 will run things that Win 7 does. So Google Intel Management Engine Verification Utility. It's a small little – it's about half a meg, 500 and some K, a zip file containing six files. You can run that, and so that will check your machine locally to see – if you have the Intel Management Engine present, and it confirmed that my X1 Carbon did. How To Geek has an article, How to Remotely Control Your PC Even When It Crashes,
That's the point of the Management Engine.
Correct.
It's an enterprise feature designed for the IT department to manage your system remotely.
Right.
So it's not nefarious that it exists. It's just.
Oh, no, no. And I never meant to explain it. The problem is it's – you know, Intel was absolutely secretive,
right?
And it was always a concern.
Especially in the open source community, they hated that this thing existed,
right?
And you buy an open source system, you build an open source, and you still have some proprietary blob that you can't examine. And now all of their fears are proven true.
Correct.
Terrible.
And then the last link is it's an Intel community site titled How to Find Intel vPro Technology-Based PCs. And unfortunately, it's not a simple way, but that link, also in the show notes, there are like four different ways you can check your system to see whether it has vPro technology and thus has this ME component. And bottom line is, it would be good to look for any firmware updates. It's not something we all do all the time. I mean, even the firmware documentation generally says, unless you are actually having a problem that you know this firmware will fix, better just to leave well enough alone. In this case, if you've got the problem, it's again, because it's so underdocumented, I can't gauge how exploitable this is. I don't know, for example, what traffic this is sniffing on the primary NIC on a motherboard to know whether, how a remote exploit would be affected. Because, for example, if it were some obscure port, and it had to come in on an obscure port, or if it was an obscure protocol, I mean, it could be anything that works in an intranet. I don't even know if it's for sure that it's routable. And that's the problem. It's a big black box. But now we know Intel is calling it a critical, remotely exploitable vulnerability. And so,
are there exploits that we know of?
No. As far as we know, it's been done. Now, I did run across anecdotal supposition, but again, that's just all it is. We call that now fake news, I guess, in this era. But there are people who are claiming that this has been exploited, but without evidence. So I ignore that because Intel really did try to tighten this down. I believe you have to have a certificate that the Intel Management Engine recognizes. So traffic needs to be signed. It is encrypted over and secured with TLS. So I mean, it looks like the bar is very likely high. On the other hand, Intel has called this critically remotely exploitable. So hopefully, I mean, it's good news that they're finally responding. I wish I could gauge its true exploitability for our listeners, but there's just no information. So I will certainly be looking for more. This just happened yesterday. So, I mean, again, as you said, Leo, even though a number of researchers have been saying to Intel, you know, tell us about this, and several people have been saying, in fact, the first of, at the very end of this report, I have a site is semiaccurate.com, which is not the most encouraging domain name.
Yeah.
Not the most encouraging domain name, but and the page is remote security exploit 2008 Intel platforms. It is in the URL at semiaccurate.com. And this guy just rakes them over the coals, saying that he's been pounding on them forever to like fix this, telling them, and they've just been ignoring him. So anyway, I have some new 1U Intel servers that I will be deploying. The one that I've already got in place is got its own external physical hardware firewall, because it's where I will be bringing up the public GRC forums to support Squirrel. They've been online for almost a year now, but I haven't taken them public yet. And so it's already protected, but I mean, it is an Intel motherboard and it's a state-of-the-art chipset, so I'm sure it's got this. And I will be updating its BIOS before it sees the light of day. And it's just frustrating for a researcher to be kept in the dark by something that looks like it's really important. Because how do you mitigate this if you know nothing about it? But all we can do is respond by updating our BIOSes. Hopefully. I don't know. This needs to be a lesson somewhere about the danger of absolutely black boxes.
Well, it's an opportunity at this point for AMD, and I hope AMD takes advantage of this. There's been some encouragement for AMD to make sure that their new Ryzen processors are Core Boot, Libre Boot compatible. They don't have this management engine. Don't have any unknown blobs. And I think a lot of people, certainly in the free software space, would be jumping on board. Could be very good for AMD. I would disappointing. Disappointing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Speaking of disappointing, five researchers at the University of Michigan have published their research, which went public last week during the IEEE European Symposium on Security and Privacy. The research paper, and I've got a link in the show notes to the PDF. It's like a 17-pager. It goes on and on, but titled "Open Doors for Bob and Mallory." I should mention we talked about Alice and Bob as being the standard characters that are used to sort of in schematic form to talk about two parties communicating securely. Well, Mallory, by convention, is the man in the middle, thus man and Mallory. So M for Mallory. And so this is Open Doors for Bob and Mallory, Open Port Usage in Android Apps and Security Implications. And I'll just share their abstract where they pull all of this, the 17 pages down into the kernel, but summarizes beautifully what they found. They write, open ports are typically used by server software to serve remote clients. Of course, we know that. And the usage historically leads to remote exploitation due to insufficient protection. You know, can anyone see, say, Mirai botnet? Of course, that's, open ports or Windows printer and file sharing. Smartphone operating systems inherit the open port support. But since they are significantly different from traditional server machines in performance and availability guarantees, little is known about how smartphone applications use open ports and what the security implications are. In this paper, we performed the first systematic study of open port usage on mobile platforms and their security implications. To achieve this goal, we design and implement OP Analyzer, a static analysis tool which can effectively identify and characterize vulnerable open port usage in Android applications. Using OP Analyzer, we perform extensive usage and vulnerability analysis on a data set with over 100,000 Android applications. OP Analyzer successfully classifies 99% of the mobile usage of open ports into five distinct families. And from the output, we're able to identify several mobile-specific usage scenarios, such as data sharing in physical proximity. In our subsequent vulnerability analysis, we find that nearly half of the usage is unprotected and can be directly exploited remotely. From the identified vulnerable usage, we discover 410 vulnerable applications with 956 potential exploits in total, so just shy of 1,000 exploits. We manually confirmed the vulnerabilities for 57 applications, including popular ones, with between 10 and 50 million downloads on the official market, and also an app that is pre-installed on some device models. These vulnerabilities can be exploited to cause highly severe damage, such as remotely stealing contacts, photos, and even security credentials, and also performing sensitive actions such as malware installation and malicious code execution. We have reported these vulnerabilities and already got acknowledged by the application developers for some of them. We also propose countermeasures and improved practices for each usage scenario. To get an initial estimate on the impact of these vulnerabilities in the wild, we performed a port scan in our campus network and immediately found a number of mobile devices in 2 minutes which were potentially using these vulnerable apps. We've reported these vulnerabilities to the relevant parties through the vulnerability tracking systems, and they've now got registered CVE and CERT registrations. Some of them have been acknowledged. We encourage readers to view several short attack video demos, and there's a site that I had the links for here in the show notes. In the show notes. So finally, under their threat model, there are three ways these can be attacked. They said the threat to an app with open ports comes from the attackers with the ability to reach these ports. In the design of popular smartphone operating systems such as Android, ports are reachable from both the same device, for example, another app or a script on the web page, and another host in the same network with the victim device. Thus, compared to the majority of previously reported smartphone app vulnerabilities that only consider the threat from on-device malware, open port apps additionally face threats from network attackers, in other words, the local network attacks, and web attackers, meaning malicious scripts, which is much more diverse and also of wider range. More specifically, in this paper, we consider the following three adversaries: malware on the same device, a local network attacker, and malicious scripts on the web. And I'll just note that they write, when a victim user visits an attacker-controlled website using their mobile device, malicious scripts running in the handset's browser can or delivered through an ad can exploit the vulnerable open ports on the device by sending network requests, which doesn't require permission. For each of these three threat models, we have prepared short attack video demos on our website to help readers more concretely understand their practical exploitation. And so if we hearken back to Fire Sheep, remember that the scenario there was in an unencrypted Wi-Fi environment, such as, for example, the often used Starbucks example. What Fire Sheep allowed was it was doing promiscuous sniffing of all the network traffic and parsing the non-encrypted, that is the HTTP transactions. Any query that, for example, a browser that was at the time, back then, logged into Facebook using HTTP, in order to maintain the persistent login, the session cookie was sent with every browser query back to Facebook. So a passive sniffer of network traffic could grab that cookie and log in, essentially clone the logged in session by itself sending that cookie, and they would be logged in as someone. So that's what Fire Sheep did. It was called Fire Sheep because it was a plugin that ran on Firefox that just, it was freaky. If you ran Fire Sheep at Starbucks, down the left-hand column would come up the identities of people surrounding you in the coffee shop, and you could click on one of them and be logged in as them. So those days changed, because pretty much now all of those major services are HTTPS exclusively, and so all of that traffic is encrypted. What this means, so relative to that, now we have a situation where Android apps running on Android devices are, in many cases, opening up listening ports for whatever reason. And they're often open and left open and are vulnerable. So a port scan within a non-encrypted Wi-Fi environment like Starbucks will find those open ports and can often identify the apps and then exploit them. In other words, you know, we're always talking about how our contemporary desktop OSs now always have a firewall between the OS and the external internet. And so we have that line of defense. Then we also have a NAT router that we're behind. So that allows machines in the network to in the private network to communicate with each other. But both the local firewall and the NAT router protect us from the public internet. The concern here is that it turns out that, and what these researchers found, is a substantial number of Android apps are opening ports which are then vulnerable to local scan. And in order to provide their functionality, they are not firewalled. Now you'll still be protected within your local network by the NAT router that bridges you to the public network, but this is still a large attack surface. So anyway, I'm glad these guys did the research and have brought it to everyone's attention. I'm sure I talked to you, Leo, about how annoyed I was that iOS didn't make it easy for me to move things back and forth, but between my desktop, my Windows-based desktop, and an iOS device. I found an app which is exactly like this, which brings up a web server or an FTP server. Actually, in this case, I use it as an FTP server. And I've got it now on several of my iOS devices. I, of course, because I'm very security conscious, I always make sure to turn it off when I'm not using it so that it closes that port. But it's very handy. I fire it up. I like if I want to I want to just grab a big photo, for example, without having to like email it to myself because I don't have iMessage under Windows, so I can't message it to myself. So I'll turn this little server on, put the photo in it, and then I have a shortcut that allows my browser to immediately bring up the FTP server that the iPad is now hosting, and I can just click on it and suck the file right over. So this is one of those apps. There is an Android app. It is a Wi-Fi file sharing utility, and the problem is that port is open and makes this app vulnerable. And as we know, the first level is access to the server, but then what we find is that the servers are not themselves secure. So even if the server was password protected and trying to only offer limited things, I would argue, unless it's been pounded on, it's almost sure to have some mistake made that could convert this into either denial of service, crashing the app, maybe the phone, depending upon where the server is running, how deep in the kernel service is, or maybe give someone access to even more data. And these researchers apparently were able to do that. So I guess the takeaway for our listeners is, if you're aware that you are running any device like this, that is any app in an Android-based device, be sure to turn it off. Disable it when you're not actively using it. Very much the same way we've always been saying, turn off Bluetooth unless you need it on. It's been a constant annoyance that every time Apple updates iOS, they turn it back on again. And so it's like turning it off if you just don't need it. It saves power and also reduces your attack surface. And for people who are a little more technically savvy and curious, there are, and we've talked about them before, local port scanners, turn your Android device on, determine what its local LAN IP is. That will be a 192.168.something.something typically. And then from a different machine, you could run a local port scan. Scan all 64K, 65535 ports of that IP from your machine and see if you find anything open. The scan shouldn't take long, but it would give you an idea of what ports that Android device has open. And then what's important to remember is that those ports are open wherever you go. So as you roam around and the device connects to various networks, all of those ports are exposed. So doing a local port scan of an Android smartphone probably this research would suggest is very worthwhile. If nothing else, if it shows nothing open, then you have the peace of mind of knowing that. But if it surprises you, you'll want to find out what apps are opening what and for why. Because if you can reach them from a machine through Wi-Fi, anybody else can, anytime you're connected to a non-encrypted network. And probably even a network you have to log into, although it wouldn't be as easy as doing a passive scan. You'd have to work a little – bad guys have to work a little harder. But this looks like a potentially big nugget. And I need a coffee refill.
I sensed that. And probably, says, I know what you're thinking. I need caffeine. Steve will be back with more in just a moment, but first a word from our fine sponsor. This portion of the Security Now Show brought to you by
ZipRecruiter, if you're in the enviable yet unenviable position of hiring for your company because you're the HR person or because it's your company and there's no one else to do it, you got to know about ZipRecruiter. Let's stipulate, I think this is a safe thing, the perfect person for that job opening is out there somewhere. I mean, there's millions of job seekers out there in the United States right now. The one of them's got to be just right for that job. And you know, probably many more are terrible for that job. You don't want to hire the wrong person. That's just setting up a disaster. But if you could get that right person, man, everybody'd be so happy. What's the best way to reach them? Well, you could go and post to every single job board in the nation. I wouldn't do that. I would do ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter lets you post to 100-plus job sites with a single click, including social networks like Facebook and Twitter. You're maximizing your reach, reaching out to candidates in any city, any industry, anywhere in the country. You post it once, and you watch the applications roll in. And because they're going to, you know, they're a job site themselves, ZipRecruiter, they're going to have millions of resumes to match right away. So you're literally, in the first 24 hours, going to get all these applicants. Now, you might say, well, I don't want people calling me. And I don't want all those hundreds of applications in my inbox. Don't worry. That's not how it works. It goes right into the ZipRecruiter interface. And that makes it so easy for you. You just go to your ZipRecruiter account. They've pre-formatted all the resumes so they're uniform and easy to read. You can supply screening questions, too. Yes, no, true, false, a, you know, multiple choice. So you can literally, you know, have you ever been convicted of grand larceny? You can screen out the people you don't want, narrow, hone in on the ones you do, rank them, and pick the right person fast. It is an amazing process. I know because we've used it here, and I know you're going to want to try it. So we've set up a free trial for you right now. For big or little businesses, it's been used by many of the Fortune 100, but also by plenty of businesses, mom-and-pop businesses like mine, medium-sized businesses. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. If you are hiring, maybe you're not hiring today, remember this, though. You will want to use it. It's just the best way. Let technology take over, right? ZipRecruiter.com/twit. All right, Steve Arino, I have your audio lined up for whenever you want that, by the way.
Okay, we'll get to it in a few minutes here.
Yes.
Okay, so we've had some fun talking several times about how IoT devices are, in some cases, I guess ratting out would be the expression, their owners or their users. We had that case where there was some strange death in a hot tub and the owner of the house claimed to have no knowledge of what was going on, yet his IoT-enabled water meter showed some huge amount of water consumed between 2 and 3 a.m., presumably to wash the blood away. And so as a consequence of that, and of course, and we've also talked in terms of, like, you know, law enforcement wanting to get subpoenas for anything that the Amazon Echo device may have overheard and so forth. Well, we have
This one is wild.
It is so bizarre. So, and this is where I was saying at the top of the show that the law enforcement officials, presumably the police who showed up to respond, you know, to a 911 call, had to have just been eyeing each other like, how dumb does this guy think we are? So, as I understand it, and I'm not going to go through the whole story, I've got the link here. Sophos covered this in their Naked Security blog. And the punchline is that a man's wife was murdered, shot by his .357 Magnum, which he had purchased some time before. Their marriage had apparently been under stress for some time. They had two sons. They weren't getting along. Apparently, he was taking money from her accounts. He had a girlfriend on the side, and he said to her that he would be leaving his wife. When the police arrived, responding to the 911 call, which he placed, one arm and one leg were zip tied to the chair or a chair. And his other arm, as I pictured it, was somehow zip tied like up to his neck. And it's like, okay, is it not obvious that he did this to himself? But I guess
I can't move. Well, except for this arm and his leg.
And he tells a story about a large 6'2" hooded camo wearing intruder who was the perp behind all of this skullduggery. Anyway, the point of all this is that so he outlines all of this, and then the police tap into, you know, social media and look for any other evidence. And it turns out that his wife was wearing her Fitbit because she was planning on going out, I think it was yoga or exercise of some sort, that morning. And so it, of course, recorded, as the Fitbit does, all of her movements. And what the time-stamped record that they were able to recover contradicted the husband's version of events by more than an hour. Like, there was a complete disparity in the timeline. I guess people attempting to perpetrate crimes are going to have to be very careful about what IoT devices, whether they're, you know, baby monitors or Fitbits or anything, which is monitoring the environment. Not as easy as it once was to get away with stuff.
No, and there's cameras everywhere, and golly, it's just a lot harder than it used to be.
So, there is one of our constant themes on the show is the problems with interpreters. How surprisingly, but almost understandably, difficult it is for interpreters to be secure. The media interpreters, image interpreters, you know, all of these fancy formats we have are interpreted, meaning that even the old TIFF, the tagged image file format, well, it's composed of modules with tags which label what the module contains. And so an interpreter displays a TIFF image or a PNG or a GIF or a JPEG or an MPEG or an MP3. You know, the MP3 is a compressed – it's compressed by having a representation of the audio, which is then an MP3 player reads that representation and reconstructs an audio approximation of the original sound. So a classic 28-year-old interpreter, I mean, not quite as old as Spinrite, but it's been around 28 years since 1988, is Ghost Script. And it turns out that there are some serious problems in Ghost Script. The security advisory that I could find, this has just happened, so it hasn't percolated out through all of the various places where Ghost Script is in use, but I mean, it is the go-to standard PostScript and PDF interpreter, which reads those high-level page descriptions and converts them into a raster image for display or printing. And so the specific vulnerabilities that I saw affected essentially all recent versions of Ubuntu from 12.04 LTS all the way up through 17.04. So if you're an Ubuntu user, the danger is, as we've also often talked about with Adobe PDFs, there's another classic, you know, the Adobe Reader. How many years of material has this podcast had thanks to Adobe's PDF problems? Well, turns out Ghost Script, may be entering the same sort of zone of having lots of problems. A researcher, Camille Frankowitz, took a close look at the latest release and discovered multiple significant vulnerabilities. GhostScript improperly handles parameters to the RSD params and EQ proc commands, which allow an attacker, exactly as was the case with Adobe's PDF reader, to deliberately craft malicious documents that could disable OS protections and thereby allow and enable execution of arbitrary code, or if they're not quite slick enough, cause a denial of service, that is, cause the application to crash. He found use after free vulnerabilities in the color management module of GhostScript, which could also at least cause a denial of service application crash. He found the divide by zero error in the scan conversion code in GhostScript, which an attacker could again leverage, and multiple null pointer dereferencing errors, which again could be leveraged for attack. So, now this is the advantage of open source. As we know, open source doesn't automatically, magically make something more secure, but it at least enables someone to examine the code and find problems. This, of course, is the problem with IME, Intel's Management Engine, is they've chosen to keep it closed and protect it to an insane level so that you can't even reverse engineer it. It's all encrypted and it decrypts on the fly, you know, into RAM and in order to run in this hidden 32-bit ARC processor. So here's two different examples. So neither open nor closed specifically says whether or not it's secure, but with something like GhostScript, which is open source, if somebody takes the time to look at it, to carefully read the code, and the people who wrote it can't do it. It's a fundamental law of the universe. You just cannot see errors in your own code. You have to have somebody else look at the code wanting to find problems, and they just reveal themselves to somebody who's sufficiently skilled in finding these kinds of security vulnerabilities, you know, a Tavis Ormandy sort of guy. So anyway, I would say Ubuntu users, be on the lookout for updates to GhostScript, and anyone else, probably any variant of Linux. Debian had a problem with a licensing change because GhostScript has been taken under the wing of someone who's moved the GhostScript code from pure GPL to a variant of that I know that Debian had a problem with, but I would imagine it's still prevalent, and it's not clear whether these were newly introduced or whether they've been longstanding. But I mean, it is the case that the oldest Ubuntu 12.02 LTS was subject to this. So I would just say to our listeners, if you know that you've got GhostScript around, if you're a Linux user and you're able to display PDFs, it's certainly GhostScript, which is the display interpreter, unless you're running a version of Adobe's PDF for Linux. It's worth checking out. Following up on our podcast from a few weeks ago on all the various ways that the information leaked, and we talked about, you know, what a VPN could do, what cookies were doing, for first party versus third party, and so forth. Somebody a few weeks ago, and I put this in my notes, and unfortunately I can't give credit to him because it got away from me, but thank you for reminding me that server name indication, SNI, which is an extension that was added to SSL and TLS way back in 2003, is yet another way that where we are going on the internet can escape. We've talked about SNI in the context not of a privacy concern, but as a feature enhancement in the past. The way servers traditionally operated, they wanted to bring up HTTPS connections or generically, more broadly, SSL or now TLS connections, is at the server side, you would bind the server's security certificate to an IP so that any connection on that IP would be secured under that the certificate bound to that interface, to that IP. So essentially the IP represented that domain that the certificate covered. The problem, of course, arose where you wanted multiple hosting. You wanted multiple domains all served from a single IP. So in order to accommodate that, an extension needed to be added to the client hello packet. That is the first packet going to the server after the TCP, the underlying TCP connection is brought up. Then the client, like typically the user's web browser, when it sends the client hello packet, which among other things lists all of the SSL or TLS protocols that it supports. And remember, so that allows the server to look at the ones it knows and hopefully choose the best one from among those that they have in common. And so then the server hello goes back to the client saying, this is the one I've chosen. And then the client in the client hello also has a nonce, a big random number, and the server also chooses one. And so they exchange their nonces, and that allows them then to negotiate a key and so forth. Well, part of the updated spec, part of the addition in the client hello, the first packet the client sends, is the SNI, the server name indication, which now all browsers, even the popular WGE tool, command line file retriever tool, it knows about it. Everything knows about it for years now. It's been in all browsers for up to 11 years. That packet has to be in plain text. It is not encrypted. It can't be encrypted because it's before the encrypted tunnel is brought up. In fact, that packet, and by reading the server name indication out of the client hello, a multiple domain, a multiply hosted server, can then choose which certificate to respond with based on the name, the domain name that is in that packet. So unfortunately, it's unencrypted, can't be encrypted, it's in plain text, and anybody sniffing traffic, even when everything else is encrypted, an ISP, you know, we did talk about how an ISP could even if you were encrypted, could see what your IP was. Well, it turns out that yes, not only that, but in the client hello packets, which are labeled brightly so that servers are able to understand them, an ISP could capture those and look at the SNI, the server name indication, in every outgoing client hello and see which domain you're going to. So they didn't even have to do reverse DNS, and they don't have a problem with multiply hosted sites not knowing which site you're going to at an IP because the client hello tells them. So I just wanted to add that to, and thanks to our listener for reminding me that server name indication is yet another way that our privacy leaks, despite everything we want to do. And there's no solution for that. All you could do would be to VPN yourself past your ISP's view and then let your traffic out onto the internet in some public location where you're not worried about it being captured and looked at. Okay, now here's another. this is the week of bad problems for some reason. Mayday. Yeah, this is really bad.
It's so bad he can't even say it.
Microsoft Edge browser has a vulnerability, believe it or not, that is not patched, that was not disclosed responsibly, that allows arbitrary sites that you visit to steal your cookies and passwords for other sites.
Well, that's kind of a flaw.
I know. That's why I'm breathless. A serious same origin policy bypass. We've talked many times about how crucial it is that browsers honor the same origin policy. That's the idea that code running in like that came from a certain domain cannot just arbitrarily go look at some other domain. It's able to go make other requests of its own domain, that is the of its own origin, the same origin, but not others. So the sandboxing with within origin sandboxing is crucial. So this security researcher, he's like focuses on browser security, and in fact his domain is called brokenbrowser.com. He's found in the past some more than 500 vulnerabilities in browsers and gleefully reports them. This is, his name is Manuel Caballero, based in Buenos Aires. And apparently he has no interest in responsible disclosure. Doesn't seem to be any no concern given to it. He has posted proof of concept exploits. He's got videos demonstrating it. This affects Microsoft's premier Edge browser, for which there is no current patch. And again, I'm sort of speechless. This vulnerability can be exploited to allow an attacker to obtain a user's password and cookie files for their other online accounts. It leverages some mistakes Edge's developers made in the handling of so-called domainless pages, such as about:blank. About:blank is a domainless page. And it turns out that there have been problems in the past that Edge has fixed, and this guy found another one, a way around the previous fixes. So it feels like there's a fundamental architectural mistake that was made in the Edge's design, which they have now been patching, because this just shouldn't be a problem. And he keeps finding other ways around it. So versions of proof of concept demos are hosted online at his site at brokenbrowser.com. And since you may not, and I mean, they actually work. So if you go there with a Microsoft Edge browser, you can have your other sites, your Facebook and Google and Amazon and so forth, password and session cookies shown to you. But since you probably don't want to do that, he has also posted video demos, which are available. And all of this is now in the public domain. He notes that the vulnerability can be customized to dump the passwords or cookies of any other online service, including Facebook, Amazon, and others. The flaw affects only Edge because universal cross-site scripting and same origin bypasses, as he writes, tend to be specific to individual browsers. Well, thank goodness for that, but this is still bad. Because, as we know, modern ads deliver JavaScript code to browsers, attackers can leverage malvertising campaigns to automate the delivery of this exploit to thousands of victims or more. Manuel explained that attackers are able to use malvertising to push their malicious code into cheap banners shown on popular sites. If an attacker is hosted inside a Yahoo banner and the user is logged into their Twitter account, that user can be owned with no interactions at all. And this is true, and he demonstrates it. So this is bad. I mean, this is like the flip side of responsible disclosure. It's unfortunate that this is now out in public and apparently there's no fix. The only thing I could suggest people do, if this is a concern, because it doesn't seem to be a workaround. I mean, look for workarounds. I will certainly mention it next week.
I don't know.
I would say use Edge. I would, switch to Chrome and stay away from Edge until this gets fixed.
Since that's the primary rendering engine on Windows 10, I wonder how often it gets used without your intention. Probably an email.
Yes,
right?
Yes, good point. Yeah. Very good point. So, where are we? This is Tuesday the 2nd. So our May patch, our May patch Tuesday will be next Tuesday. It would be wonderful if Microsoft had time to fix this by then. This has to have lit a fire under them because this is really bad. And it sounds like it should be an easy fix. Whatever it is this guy found, I would imagine they can patch their way around it and get it fixed. And let's hope they do that. Have another coffee break.
Well, that's good because you know what? I have another ad.
Perfect.
This show is brought to you in living color or, stereo audio, whichever you prefer. Thanks to the good folks at Sonic, literally brought to you by Sonic, our 10 gigabit symmetric fiber connection to the outside world. Thank you, Sonic. Thank you. We're not worthy. I tell you, they are and always have been one of the greatest internets. I'm going to say the greatest internet service provider in the country. If you have any questions about them, go to the EFF. They have an ISP rating chart for how an ISP, protects your privacy, whether they have bandwidth caps, how are they good, all of that stuff. Just green checks. This is the Electronic Frontier Foundation. SonicNet is the ISP we all deserve. Unfortunately, we can't all get it, but if you're in California, you ought to check it out. Let me tell you what you get. Now, you're not going to get the symmetric 10 gigabit fiber. You probably don't need that. I'm sure you don't even have a machine that could take 10 gigabits. We don't. But does your machine have a gigabit card in it? You probably could do. Well, how about that? How about residential? And by the way, they do have business plans, but residential, business fiber, or business fiber to the premise, gigabit connectivity. It's in the San Francisco Bay Area, North Bay, the East Bay. You get, it just blows me away what you get. Internet service, of course, 15 email accounts, a gigabyte of storage, personal web hosting with a new domain and fax line service. You also get a home phone connection with unlimited local and long distance calling. That's included. And download speeds of up to 1,000 megabits per second. A gigabit. All of that. $40 a month. This is the kind of thing everybody ought to be able to get. Unfortunately, you have to be in the right neighborhood, but if you are, Sonic stands up for privacy. They have great, friendly local customer support from just up the road a piece in Santa Rosa. No bandwidth caps. None. Unfortunately, I can't get Sonic fiber in the house. We have it here. So I come in here when I want to download stuff. And by the way, it is so, I should pull up the bandwidth. I won't do that. I won't rub it in your face in it. But it's amazing. It's amazing. Affordable pricing, great service, great product, and customer advocacy to improve internet in the United States. Join the internet revolution. Sonic, SONIC.com/twit. Get your first month of Sonic internet and phone service free. And if you bundle it with Dish, they offer that too. Save $120 on your Sonic bill. Sonic.com/twit. Thank you, Sonic, for giving us just the best darn internet service in the world. I'm so happy to have it. Even Steve, it's so good, even Steve can't get it.
I'm jealous.
I'm sure he would love it. Jabug in our chat room says he's a Sonic customer. He loves it. Of course they are. Yeah. Great. Yeah.
So Chrome has made a change to the way they handle certificates that I thought was interesting. They are deprecating in Chrome 58, their use of the subject name field, which sort of it's called the subject common name, which is like the way the certificate identifies itself. The problem is that the way the common name was originally defined was never very rigorous. For example, I think I've got www.grc.com as my certificate's, my main certificate's common name. But I noticed that ever since I started using DigiCert, they also placed it, that is the www.grc.com, in the SAN field, the subject alternative name. And traditionally, the subject alternative name, as its description sounds, is our alternative names. And this is, for example, how you can get one certificate from a certificate authority, which can be used on like three different domains, where, for example, I might have grc.com, www.grc.com, and media.grc.com. You would have the common name would be one of them, and then the alternative names would be the other two. But I noted that DigiCert, again, they're on top of their game. They were always putting all three in the subject alternative name. Well, it turns out that the industry has been souring over time over the use of the actual value in the common name as standing for something. So for a while, Chrome's behavior was to prefer the subject alternative name field, but if it was missing, then to fall back to using the common name, assuming that the common name would be the domain name that was bound in the certificate. Although, again, it was never rigorously defined. The format wasn't defined. It's considered an untyped field, which makes everybody nervous, whereas the subject alternative name, being more recent, was rigorously defined from the start. Anyway, so the change is significant. That is, with 58, the fallback path is removed. And from now on, and this is – so this represents really a change for the industry. The common name will still be in certificates, but browsers moving forward, and Firefox is on the same trajectory, will no longer be using the common name for any use other than display purposes in the certificate. The browser will no longer rely on that. So the reason this could affect individuals is that a popular thing to do is to generate self-signed certificates. And many of the original self-signing tools do not support subject alternative name fields. They only self-sign, and the domain that you're signing is in the common name. Well, users of those certificates will suddenly discover that Chrome no longer honors those self-signed certificates. The good news is there are newer tools for generating fully compliant certificates, but that may mean that people who have long expiration self-signed certificates are going to need to create updated certificates, which Chrome from 58 on and soon Firefox will continue to honor. So just sort of an interesting something that Google, I think, is doing the right thing in doing in continuing to move forward and, you know, clean up a little bit of what's been done before. We have a mystery botnet that's got a lot of people wondering what's going on. It's a new IoT botnet. It's being called the Vigilante botnet, which has been growing rapidly. It was first spotted in October of last year, of 2016. It's also known as the Hey Jimmy, H A J I M E H.
Hey Jimmy.
Hey Jimmy botnet. What's puzzling people is that it is extremely well designed and sophisticated, with a robustness and feature set that surpasses its overtly malicious rivals, like the Mirai botnet, for example. It is expending a huge amount of effort to infect other IoT devices. But unlike Mirai, once Hey Jimmy affects an IoT device, it closes the back doors behind itself, securing those devices it has infected against further attacks. It blocks access to ports 23, 7547, 555, and 5358, which are known to be the most widely used vectors for infecting IoT devices. And thus, at least temporarily, it sanitizes that device in its wake. But rather than using the more common fixed command and control server architectures that we've been talking about, Hey Jimmy employs a decentralized peer-to-peer network to issue updates to infected devices, making it far more difficult for the botnet to be taken down. I would argue impossible by anyone. And what's also strange is that when infected devices are also equipped with display terminals, every 10 minutes or so, it displays a signed message describing its creators as, quote, just a white hat securing some systems. And then it says important messages will be signed like this. Hey, Jimmy, author, contact closed, stay sharp. And it's like, okay. So, unlike Mirai and other IoT botnets, Hey Jimmy lacks DDoS capability.
You've adopted my pronunciation of Hey Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, come on over, Jimmy.
Lacks DDoS capabilities and other hacking skills or capabilities, except for the propagation code that lets one infected IoT device search for other vulnerable devices and then infects them. Kaspersky's security researchers noted that, quote, the most intriguing thing about Hey Jimmy is its purpose. While the botnet, it never gets old, while the botnet is getting bigger and bigger, now we're talking 300,000 infected devices at this point, by the way.
That system has a big network.
A third of a million, partly due to new exploitation modules, so it's evolving also. Its purpose remains unknown. Kaspersky says we haven't seen it being used in any type of attack or malicious activity. Its real purpose remains unknown. And Radware's write-up provided some additional interesting technical details. They said the distributed bot network used for command and control and updating is overlaid as a traceless torrent on top of the well-known public BitTorrent peer-to-peer network, using dynamic info hashes that change on a daily basis. All communications through BitTorrent are signed and encrypted using RC4 with public and private keys. The current extension module provides scan and loader services to discover and infect new victims. The efficient SYN scanner implementation scans for open ports on TCP port 23 and TCP 5358. Upon discovering open telnet ports, the extension module tries to exploit the victim using brute force shell login, much the same way Mirai did. For this purpose, Hey Jimmy uses a list consisting of the 61 factory default passwords from Mirai and adds two new entries, root slash root is the username, 5up is the password, and admin as the username and 5up as the password, which are factory defaults for Atheros wireless routers and access points. In addition, Hey Jimmy is capable of exploiting Aeris modems using the password of the day backdoor with the default seed as outlined here. Hey Jimmy does not rashly follow a fixed sequence of credentials from Radware's honeypot logs. They were able to conclude that the credentials used an exploit change depending on the login banner of the victim. I mean, this thing is top drawer. In doing so, Hey Jimmy increases its chances of successfully exploiting the device within a limited set of attempts to avoid the system account being locked out or its IP being blacklisted for a set amount of time. Radware also suggested that the flexible and extensible nature of the Hey Jimmy botnet would allow it to be used for malicious purposes, including conducted real-time mass surveillance from internet-connected webcams. However, since Hey Jimmy has no persistence mechanism, as soon as the infected device is rebooted, it goes back to its previously unsecured state with default passwords and the telnet port open to the world. Now, there's no evidence of this, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if this is, I mean, I would be happy in a way if this was the NSA. That is, here we have a situation where Mirai brought down Dyn DNS last year because so many of these IoT devices were infected that a hugely powerful, what was it? It was 600 gig or something, a ridiculous amount of traffic was able to be generated. So now along comes a botnet which you cannot take down that uses high-end torrent encrypted BitTorrent system intercommunication with rotating password of the day seed-based passwords that protects the devices it infects from subsequent infection, stays in RAM, doesn't hurt them, doesn't destroy them, but takes them essentially out of service and is, due to its architecture, incredibly hard to kill. This feels like and at the same time, is a massive surveillance network. Should the owner of this network choose to exploit these IoT devices, we've never seen any evidence of this, and reverse engineering of the implant demonstrates all it does is rapidly find other vulnerable devices, presumably those that have been recently rebooted, and reinfects them with it, as you know, before anybody else can find them, in order to essentially cleanse this otherwise very worrisome IoT install base of this latent problem. This to me, this feels like a state actor who's solving this IoT problem for us.
So does it give you any clues that Hajime is Japanese? It's the first name of a boxing manga series, comic book series, Hajime no Ippo.
Well, and I don't know who named it. So, you know,
Maybe they saw that text string in there or something like that.
Could be. I did not find any reference to where the name came from.
Anybody in the chat room speak Japanese? Does Hajime mean anything in Japanese?
Oh, I do know what it meant because I looked it up this morning when I got the pronunciation. But I don't remember.
I like, hey, Jimmy. Hey, Jimmy. Oh, hey, Jimmy. How are you? Good to see you.
Yeah. So We're all familiar with the
beginning in Japanese. Beginning.
Ah, interesting.
It's a Japanese martial arts term. That's scary.
Yeah, it is a little. So we're all familiar with the concept of a breathalyzer, where if law enforcement pulls you over when you're driving and believes that maybe you are intoxicated, traditionally you could blow into this device and it would register your current blood alcohol level as indicated by the alcohol content in your expiration. Well, NPR reports that legislation has passed in New York, which may pave the way for a textilizer. They write, if you're one of the many who text, read email, or view Facebook on your phone while driving, be warned. Police in your community may soon have a tool for catching you red-handed. The new textilizer technology is modeled after the breathalyzer, except it's not, and would determine if you had been using your phone illegally on the road. Lawmakers in New York and a handful of other cities and states are considering allowing the police to use the device to crack into phones because they say too many people get away with texting and driving and causing crashes. I'm going to skip a bunch of this reporting, which is about a personal story of somebody who was involved in a distracted driver crossing the center line and causing an accident that resulted in a death, and how difficult it was to generate probable cause to get a subpoena to pull the records. And skipping down, it says, even though New York and most other states ban texting and other kinds of cell phone use while driving, this individual, Lieberman, says those lawsuits are difficult to enforce. The takeaway is our current law is a joke. Lieberman, along with the advocacy group he co-founded, has been working with a company, and we know them, Cellebrite, which are, the people who –
they make those cell phone suckers.
Exactly. Cellebrite has been developing the textilizer. It would be able to determine – whether a driver illegally was using a phone in the moments before a crash. Cellebrite engineer Lee, and here's a name, Papathanasiou, Papathanasiou.
Yeah, that's Greek, Papathanasiou.
Papathanasiou.
Papathanasiou
demonstrated the device for lawmakers, who could finally pronounce his name, and reporters at the New York State Capitol in Albany earlier last week. He says a police officer just goes to the driver and attaches a cord to connect the device to the phone. The driver doesn't even have to let go of the device. Papathanasiou said, quote, they simply tap one button. It will process for about 90 seconds or so, then display what the last activities were. Again, that could be a text message and so on, but also web activity and touchscreen use with a timestamp. The device would display a summary of what apps on the phone were open and in use, he says, as well as screen taps and swipes. Quote, for example, if it was a WhatsApp message or a call, it will indicate what the source was, the timestamp, and then what the direction of the communication was. So if it was an outgoing call versus an incoming call. Papathanasiou says the technology still is not yet fully developed, but would be tailored to what's legal in each jurisdiction that approves its use. And he insists that the textilizer would only capture taps and swipes to determine if a driver was using the phone, that it would not download content, and that it would be able to tell if the driver was using a phone legally, hands-free. In New York, The bill authorizing police to use the textilizer has passed out of one committee and is pending in the next. Lawmakers are interested in the device in New Jersey and Tennessee and Chicago, as well as other cities, and as they consider ways to get drivers to focus on the road instead of their phones. So I'm a little suspicious of whether they can pull this off, because they've demonstrated success in getting into phones, but at least at the moment, that's not something that the phones support. Although this is one of those things where it might not be surprising to see that kind of technology officially enabled in phones for exactly this kind of purpose. I don't know. But wow. We do know that this distracted driving is a real issue. I look at cars weaving on the road, and we've talked here many times about how lights will turn green and no one's car moves.
Right.
They're all taking a time out, and they go, oh, and then off they go. Yeah.
Wow.
We know we have SaaS, S-A-A-S, Software as a Service. Now there is RAS, R-A-A-S, Ransomware as a Service. Yes, for just $175, $175. A new ransomware service on offer from a Russian-speaking user is reputed to be a boon to less technically capable cyber criminals. Going by the name Carmen, K-A-R-M-E-N, anyone can deploy this easy-to-use drop-in ransomware kit without any need to understand how it works. The security firm Recorded Future posted last week that a Russian-speaking user called DevBitox, D-E-V-B-I-T-O-X, has been advertising the ransomware in underground forums. Carmen, the name of this ransomware, is part of a worrisome new trend known as ransomware as a service. It allows less technically skilled amateur hackers with little technical know-how to inexpensively purchase access, in return for which they receive a complete suite of web-based tools to develop their own ransomware attacks. In Carmen's case, it offers an easy-to-use dashboard interface. Buyers can modify the ransomware, view what machines are infected, and see how much they've earned. Yeah, I guess it was inevitable. But it's ransomware is going to be with us for the foreseeable future. And finally, the FCC has announced its plan to reverse Title II's enforced net neutrality. The Verge reported, and this has got heavy coverage, the Federal Communications Commission is cracking open the net neutrality debate yet again, with a proposal to undo the 2015 rules that implemented net neutrality with Title II classification. FCC's chairman, Ajit Pai, called the rules, the rules enacted in 2015, so we have a new FCC chairman in the Trump administration, calling these rules heavy-handed, and said their implementation was, quote, all about politics. I guess that may be true. He argued that they hurt investment and said that small internet providers don't have, quote, the means or the margins to withstand the regulatory onslaught. Okay. Ajit Pai said last Wednesday, earlier today, I shared with my fellow commissioners a proposal to reverse what he called the mistake of Title II classification and return to the light touch framework that served us so well, as he put it, during the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the first 6 years of the Obama administration. The Verge writes, his proposal will do three things. First, it'll reclassify internet providers as Title I information services, which I happen to think is a mistake. Second, it'll prevent the FCC from adapting any net neutrality rules to practices that internet providers haven't thought up yet. And third, it'll open questions about what to do with several key net neutrality rules, like no blocking or throttling of apps and websites that were implemented and put in place in 2015. Pai said the full text of his net neutrality proposal would be published, and presumably it was, on last Thursday afternoon, because this statement came out on last Wednesday. It'll be voted on by the FCC at a meeting on May 18th, so a little more than 2 weeks from today. From there, months of debate will follow as the item is opened up for public comment. And I think all of us listening need to take advantage of this and you know, make sure that our representatives in Washington know what we feel about this. The commission will then revise its rules based on the feedback it receives. Let's hope that's true, before taking a final vote to enact them. And then The Verge continues, strong net neutrality rules were passed in 2015 and have been in place for about 2 years. Those rules reclassified internet providers as common carriers under Title II of the Telecommunications Act, which subject them to tough utility-style regulations. Amen. The FCC has previously mandated under Title II that internet providers follow a few key rules: no blocking of sites and apps, no throttling the speed of sites and apps, and no paid fast lanes. The rules applied to both wired and wireless internet providers and also gave the commission oversight of interconnect agreements between internet providers and big content companies like Netflix. Internet providers have, of course, been unhappy about this, as they'd rather not have the FCC looking over their shoulder and limiting what they're able to do with their network. They sued to overturn the rules, but so far the rules have held up in court. But that may not last. So, once again, you know, we have all of us little folks who are trying to keep the internet open, yet we have major, you know, huge, well-financed, deep-pocket ISPs that say they need the flexibility to do with their traffic what they want. You know, they're wanting to be considered information providers rather than common carriers. And to my thinking, that maybe a solution would be for them to bifurcate. If they want to do some things, then split themselves into half so that there's a common carrier portion that carries the traffic and then an adjunct that can offer content. But mixing these things together is just a recipe for trouble. And I just hope there is yet again another very loud outcry for keeping things as they are and keeping our ISPs regulated under Title II.
Yeah, we fixed this last time. Tom Wheeler wasn't going to do this. This chairman used to see the time. And he opened it for comment and literally more than a million comments.
Yep.
And it convinced him of the merit of choosing Title II. That and the president's urging that he do so. I think we're in a different climate, so we'll see what happens. But we can make those millions of comments again. I think we need
to. Yeah, it's absolutely worth doing to revoice our position.
Yep.
Cloudflare, who, as our listeners know, has become a sponsor of the TWiT Network Netcast, has launched a new service. And I don't completely understand it, but I'm sure we will with time. It's called Orbit. You can find out. There's a short write-up at www.cloudflare.com/orbit, O-R-B-I-T. And it is a new service to protect IoT devices. In their write-up, they said, technology is changing, shifting towards a world where low-cost connected chips power products used by billions of people around the world. Everything from jet turbines and oil rigs to cars, cameras, and clothing are coming online. And while these tiny chips unlock incredible potential, they are a liability if not secure, to which I add, amen. When PC vulnerabilities are discovered, they write, software vendors issue a patch, which end users are required to download and install. These patches keep PC software up to date and secure. IoT devices also require patches, but the PC security model cannot scale to 22 billion devices. IoT manufacturers often haven't built over-the-air update mechanisms and are terrified that updates will brick a user's device. In the meantime, consumers never think about having to upgrade their internet-connected toaster, Cloudflare has in quotes. Cloudflare Orbit solves this problem at the network level by creating a secure and authenticated connection between an IoT device and its origin server. Orbit takes the internet out of IoT. Behind Orbit, devices are, and then they have IOT. Orbit allows device manufacturers to instantly deploy virtual patches and block vulnerabilities across all devices on the network simultaneously. In other words, Cloudflare is imposing, this is me speaking, Cloudflare is imposing itself as a big proxy serving, a proxy server network in between the all of these IoT devices and the public internet, or the server that is intended to serve the IoT devices that exist on the public internet. And then going back to what they say, this keeps malicious requests from reaching devices, buys time for IoT manufacturers to carefully QA their updates, and keeps devices from leaking data or launching DDoS attacks. And I should mention also that that also allows them, that allows Cloudflare to put up firewall rules instantly to close ports or filter traffic which are discovered to be vulnerable for IoT devices. And it uses mutual authentication with client-side TLS certificates. We, of course, are always talking about server authentication, where the server contains a signed certificate that asserts its identity. They're suggesting the use of client-side certificates. Now, this, of course, is questionable because you want to keep your certificates private, and it's not clear how an IoT device can keep its can inherently keep its certificate private. For example, you know, GRC and any public server goes to great lengths to keep its private key, which is in its certificate, private. So I don't know how you enforce that. It's an increase in security. A spokesman for Cloudflare said, quote, Orbit sits one layer before the device and provides a shield of security. So even if the device is running past its operating system's expiration date, Cloudflare protects it from exploits. And while devices may be seldom patched, the Cloudflare security team is shipping code every day, adding new firewall rules to Cloudflare's edge. Orbit, and this is something I didn't know, but it's already in place. Orbit has been built in collaboration with a number of IoT vendors and already protects over 120 million IoT devices. It allows IoT companies to write logic on Cloudflare's edge and create firewall rules that are immediately updated to the Cloudflare Orbit layer for all devices, without having to write and ship a patch. And I noted that, is it Eero's? Eero. Those devices are being protected by Cloudflare Orbit.
Another sponsor of ours.
Yeah.
All the sponsors are working together. I like it.
Yeah. So this is not something that can be added afterwards. That is, this needs to be, you know, an IoT vendor would need to decide they want to take advantage of this service. And so they would work with Cloudflare so essentially Cloudflare sort of becomes a CDN for IoT firmware and also an internet proxy for the IoT device to hide behind so that it creates essentially Cloudflare is giving IoT vendors their scalability in order to provide useful services and features to internet connected devices, which I think sounds like a really cool idea. So it's not something that an end user needs to worry about, but it's something that IoT device manufacturers, it's a service they could use with Cloudflare to enhance the security of their IoT devices.
Fantastic.
So, you know, cheesy things aren't going to bother, but devices that care about security and are wanting to use this as a value added benefit could avail themselves of this. Nice. So bravo to Cloudflare and those device vendors who choose to use it. And I just did want to mention that Mozilla and Chrome are continuing their back and forth with Symantec. I read through a mind-numbing dialogue of, you know, we said this and they said this and then they proposed this and we read that and then we proposed that. Symantec is, of course, pushing back as fiercely as possible and wanting to do as little as possible. And this, of course, is, as we've discussed in the previous podcast, in response to rather gross violations of the responsibility of a CA, which Chrome and Fire and Mozilla have both decided they're going to take action on, that they're not going to let this stand. You know, things like removing EA certificate issuance completely, enforcing short certificates moving forward until Symantec proves and takes, you know, clear measures to demonstrate that they will be responsible moving forward, and so forth. So, the browser vendors are attempting to both appear and be understanding and reasonable, while also feeling that their true responsibility lies with their users, who are inherently trusting their browsers to keep them safe. So, I mean, this is one of those situations where there's going to be pain. And now there is an ongoing struggle to decide where the line gets drawn. So I just did want to mention this is ongoing. I'm kind of keeping an eye on it, but we don't have any conclusions yet. Some bits of errata. Erwin Wessels shot me a tweet saying, there are not individual emojis for each skin tone variety. They're modifiers / ligatures. And so that prompted me. So thank you, first of all, Erwin. That prompted me to dig in a little bit. And believe it or not, we now have emoji racial diversity. It is in the Unicode spec under diversity, if you can believe that. Of course, we had the original sort of Smurf yellow emojis those are the ones I had always used, and I misstated last week that now we had like an explosion of emojis apparently the Unicode space was big enough to accommodate them. And we also talked last week about, yes, there are 17 million more than 17 million 17 planes of 65K. I don't remember now how many million, but there was like plenty of Unicode space. Well, it turns out that what was actually done was that a skin tone modifier was added to the Unicode spec quite some time ago. in Unicode version 8 back in mid-2015. And there, so we still have the original Smurf yellow, but then we have five human skin tones ranging from, you know, white through dark, you know, kind of light white to dark brown. And that's an escape character, essentially, which can be appended to any of the existing Smurf yellow emojis to turn them into one of five skin tones. So thank you for the correction. And I find that kind of interesting. Also, I misspoke when I referred to the eternal blue and eternal, you know, the various eternal star things and double pulsar as being Vault 7, thus CIA leaks. I meant to say, and they are from the NSA's equation group, which was released by Shadow Brokers. And I think you actually corrected me, Leo, but somebody else noted that as well. Actually, several listeners. So thank you for that. And then this is not quite errata, but this is under the category of there's got to be a simpler way to say that. Joel Dittmer quoted me regarding Punicode. He said, classic at SGGRC. Apparently, I said, I don't disagree that this was never not a bad idea. What? I don't
double
disagree.
Double negative.
That this was never not a bad idea. Is that a double or a triple? Anyway.
Never not a bad idea is a good idea.
I don't disagree that this was never not a bad
idea. It was always a good idea. Is a never not a bad idea.
So there. I'm not sure what that means. Anyway, under miscellany, I did want to point our listeners to badssl.com, a cool and quick little website that checks your browser client for its feature set, shows whether it continues to support old things that it should not, whether it supports new good things. You need to, it's not quite obvious when you bring up the page, you need to click on something in order to make it run the tests. Then a bunch of things spin around and then it shows you what your browser is doing. So badssl.com. And at the bottom of that page, they remind us about that our friend Ivan Ristic, also over at ssllabs.com, has a very nice client-side SSL test with a number of different features as well. I talked about the idea of bringing up a VPN on Amazon's EC2, and I just saw as we were starting the podcast that there's a formal project for that. But there's also you're able to set up a proxy server so that you can run all of your stuff through an Amazon EC2 VPC instance. So I've got I just wanted to make a note of that and the link for the steps to do that, just 10 steps you run through, is on GitHub. Several people said after my mentioning Chromazone, the very first thing I wrote for Windows, the tool that I used to teach me how to program Windows, James Bong said, I desperately need to play around with Chromazone. How do I get it? Many other people said the same thing. I'll publish it all publicly. I'll put that page back online and put links to the code so people who can set a machine to 256 color mode can play with it. I'd be happy to have people do so. I'm really proud of it. It's sort of my masterpiece of Windows programming. And now, Leo.
I'm ready.
2 minutes of technically completely accurate. This is not gibberish as the Turbo Entabulator was, but and I know our listeners will love this because it is technically accurate description of missile guidance, but it is wonderful. So everybody, listen up.
The missile knows where it is at all times. It knows this because it knows where it isn't. By subtracting where it is from where it isn't, or where it isn't from where it is, whichever is greater, it obtains a difference or deviation. The guidance subsystem uses deviations to generate corrective commands to drive the missile from a position where it is to a position where it isn't, and arriving at a position where it wasn't, it now is. Consequently, the position where it is now the position that it wasn't, and it follows that the position that it was is now the position that it isn't. In the event that the position that it is in is not the position that it wasn't, the system has acquired a variation. The variation being the difference between where the missile is and where it wasn't. Mm. If variation is considered to be a significant factor, it too may be corrected by the GEA. However, the missile must also know where it was. The missile guidance computer scenario works as follows. Because a variation has modified some of the information the missile has obtained, it is not sure just where it is. However, it is sure where it isn't, within reason, and it knows where it was. It now subtracts where it should be from where it wasn't, or vice versa. And by differentiating this from the algebraic sum of where it shouldn't be and where it was, it is able to obtain the deviation and its variation, which is called error.
It's just algebra. Very straightforward.
Yes. So, anyway, I loved how pedantic that is, and it's technically correct.
It's accurate.
So
yeah,
it's just
X1
fun.
Minus
now,
X2. Yeah.
In the show notes, and I tweeted this, is something that does not work over the podcast, over an audio podcast, but it believe me, it is so good. 4 minutes and 10 seconds. The Cookie Monster, the Muppets Cookie Monster, consuming a machine as it describes itself.
Somebody said this is actually Ed Sullivan.
Oh, I had no idea that the Cookie Monster could be so descriptive.
Yeah, this is the Ed Sullivan show, I guess.
External components already. Let us begin. At the upper right of the modular system console, you will note the longitudinally polarized antenna, resulting in a completely unitized composite sheath. This unique design is virtually indestructible and is
yeah, you really should watch the video.
For the life of the unit. The longitudinally polarized antenna functions.
Jim Henson. That's great. That's pre-Muppets show, I think.
There is an alarm system located next to the antenna, which rings if any portion of this machine is damaged. If this alarm rings, the only way it can be silenced is by locating the origin of the malfunction.
He's eating it.
Now, immediately adjacent to the alarm is the digital iambic generator. This is probably the most valuable component in the entire system, and as such, it should be handled with extreme care.
Again,
if you were to look inside this unit, you would find a string of delicately balanced H14 analog capacitors. It takes over 185 man-hours to produce a capacitator, because each one must be painstakingly assembled with a 301 electromicrometer.
He's eating it.
These capacitators are connected into the dual exhaust intake valve. The quantum polarization of the energy transfer involved herein results in the emission of a small amount of gaseous methane, which is...
All right, you get the idea. I encourage our viewers.
It is so good. It's it's fabulous.
Yeah.
And it's got a punchline. It keeps going and it gets better. So it's worth it. I tweeted it. And again, Google Muppets Analytical Computer. Yeah. You Google Muppets Analytical Computer, you'll find it.
Wow.
Another listener tweeted, got the first Frontier Saga book. Let me tell you, wow, amazing. And I haven't been able to put it down. And that echoes the sentiments I'm getting from many of our listeners. So I'm glad to have another recommendation that people are enjoying. And I heard you refer to it also over the weekend.
Yeah, John's been reading it. I bought it on the cheap 3 volumes on Kindle. Although I notice it is available on Audible. So if I like it, I might go to the Audible.
I think you played it and it was a little nasally for
you. Yeah,
you didn't like the guy who was reading it.
Yeah. I'm enjoying reading it. I need to read letters on paper or something like paper.
Yeah. Brett Longborough is a long-term Twitter finder and sender. I recognize his name. Anyway, he said, "Hi, Steve. After years of shameless freeloading off a friend's spin right, today I purchased my own copy. Thanks and apologies. Brett, no apology needed. You're legit, and I'm glad to have you, and you'll be able to play with 6-1 during its early pre-released stages, as will everyone who has 6 at the time." And I don't know how to pronounce this. Engrippeman said at SGGRC, "Spinrite saved my database server. RAID 1 disk failed. Used SR to bring drive back to life. Made backup, got new drives, restored from backup."
Wow, that's like a whole novel in 140 characters. A beginning, a middle, and an end. Conflict, resolution, the whole thing.
The whole thing.
I'm thinking Engineer Pie Man.
Oh, nice.
But I don't know. It's like reading license plates, right?
Yeah, it is.
Engrippiman.
And then four little bits of feedback from our listeners closing the loop. John, Mr. John Morris, said, "Listening to SN607 and thought I'd share the reality of Chrome cookie settings not respecting settings." And then he sent me a photo where – actually, it was two side-by-side photos where he showed he had disabled cookies in Chrome, or third-party cookies, or first – you know, some cookies, and then went over and looked at them and found them. And I was familiar with this. I wrote back to him, and I wanted to share with our listeners, some browsers will continue to store but not to send cookies. Some will even continue to receive an update but not store or not – I'm sorry, but I not send cookies. This is exactly why I created that cookie forensics page. Because if you look there, you'll notice it shows like how stale the cookies are. We were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about stale cookies because back then when I created it, sometimes you could turn off cookies and some browsers would send the old cookies they had but wouldn't update them newly. So then they were stale. Some browsers continued to update them but didn't send them. So the fact that the browser still has the cookie and didn't delete it doesn't mean that it's still sending it, but it may just have it. And then if you were to re-enable cookies, it would immediately start sending the cookies that it had. The point is, this is very complex, potentially very complex and unintuitive behavior, but the cookie forensics page, because it actually runs through multiple cycles of exchanging cookies back and forth and analyzes the whole set of transactions, it's able to weed everything out and then summarize everything for exactly the way the browser is working. So it's not something you can statically inspect. You need to see how it actually acts, in vitro or vivo, wherever that would be. Richard Hardy tweeted, "Watching the Security Now double Pulsar episode, I had a thought about the port 445 being open. What about PCs in a DMZ?" And so that's a very the point was, I was wondering, how could there be so many systems with 445 open? And he notes, well, if you set up a DMZ on your router, by definition, unsolicited incoming traffic is not dropped, it's sent to that IP. And it's true. If you then had a machine that either didn't have its own local firewall running, and probably 445 would have to be a Windows machine or a Linux machine that had Samba running on it. If it didn't have a firewall or did have 445 open, then yes, it would be vulnerable to the SMB. The good news is all Windows systems since Windows XP SP2 have a software firewall in and enabled by default. So even that would protect you unless something on the machine had poked a hole on it or through it on purpose. So again, the DMZ is worth noting because that does certainly create a vulnerability to the machine that is the recipient of unsolicited traffic. It's like very much like having it on the public internet. But at least Windows machines where the 445 port problem is the most acute probably are protected themselves. Joan tweeted, "There are ads related to my location popping up on my Facebook feed. How do I stop this if setting up a VPN isn't enough?" And Joan, I guess I would refer you back to our podcast a couple weeks ago about the real privacy protection, the second one where we actually finally made time to get to that, because this is the problem, is that even if you VPN, then where you go still knows who you are because that's conveyed through your cookies. So what you would need to do would be to turn on incognito browsing and VPN so that your IP would change and your browser would then respect your privacy in the whatever your browser's version of incognito mode is, then you should not be known. So those two things, turning on incognito mode and use a VPN, that'll suddenly your IP will change and your browser should then, I mean, maybe fingerprinting would still be a problem of the browser. I'm not sure browser by browser how good a job they do, but they'll at least block cookies so that you are no longer logged in and the places you go don't obviously know who you still are, even though you're coming from a different location, which is the only thing that VPN really does for you is just shift your location to where the VPN's public presence is.
You can also, in many cases, the browser has a setting for location sharing. That you should do that and everything you just mentioned.
Correct.
Because if the browser's giving up your information, you're kind of
right.
Doesn't matter what you do.
That's a very good point. I've got mine set up. I don't know if it's the default, but mine, sometimes I go to web pages.
Right?
Yes, and, yeah. And they prompt, you know, yeah. Do you want this site to know where you are?
You can, in the settings, then go look and see who's got permission and who, you know, who doesn't. And you can change the settings, say, you know, never do it. Yeah.
Nice. And lastly, finally, Nate G says, he actually, in a pair of tweets, the biggest roadblock with getting friends and family on board with a password vault solution has been the master password. Any suggestions? And he continued, my wife, for example, sees the benefit of them, but has had problems remembering a high entropy password in the past, unwilling to try again now. And so, you know, empathizing with him, I said, I wrote back and I said, Nate, best advice would be to use maybe, for example, 5 memorable real words with 1 deliberate misspelling. Not the best solution possible, but not a bad compromise.
I'll tell you what I do.
Okay.
That I find very easy, and I tell people to do this. If you have a poem memorized or a song lyric memorized, let's say the Jabberwocky. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy tove did gyre and gimble in the wabe. You don't want to use the words, but you could use the first initials of each word, perhaps adding punctuation and uppercase and lowercase letters, depending on some arbitrary rule that you conceive of.
Or maybe even a comma where there would be a pause.
That's what I would recommend. I don't want to say what I do, but that's what I would recommend. And then to make it long and strong, I then add numbers, either say a child, some number that you remember. You know, the one I always tell people is a childhood phone number, because that's something you probably is not on record anywhere, but it's something you also memorized as a child, right? That was like the most important, or your childhood zip code or address, or that gives you an additional padding.
Yep.
And the two combined, I think, would be fairly strong.
I think that's good. And I'll bet that after a while, you begin to memorize it. I've got some gibberish that I've been using
for
safe places for quite a while, and I just type it without even thinking now.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. You know, people memorize stuff, and there's usually a phrase or two. And what's the length? I would say, 15 to 20, right? Just keep going until you have 20 words, and then add a phone number.
Yep. Shorter than the Canadian national anthem.
You heard me trying to remember that. Well, if you remember, but there's a good example. If you remembered the national anthem, maybe not yours, some other country's national anthem, that'd be a perfect example. Because in your head, you could actually sing it and type your password. Not the words, just the initials. I think the words might be a little bit brute forceable. I don't know. Do you think bad guys have initial brute forcers?
I think that in general, the password vaults are, like, as we know, are generally safer against brute force.
Yeah.
For example, we know that LastPass does a strong, 500 or more now.
I think.
Iteration. PBKD. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so, it makes it difficult to brute force.
Even if it were a bad password, right?
So it's certainly, yes. So it's certainly better to use a bad password with a password vault than this makes me wonder how good the passwords Nate's wife is using in general are.
Yeah.
If she's, she's probably using the vault allows you to just reduce it to a single one gnarly password. But frankly, the attack profile is such that it doesn't have to be
that gnarly.
That gnarly. Yes.
Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. And then turn on two factor. And then it's really gnarly, right? Because
that would be perfect.
LastPass supports that, so that's why I always do that too. Steve, we're done.
Oh my goodness!
Oh, that was a Quinti Venti Latte day.
Bad news week. Wow,
lots of it. Well, we'll do it again. How about this? You think there'll be enough to do a show next week?
Oh, I'm afraid there will be.
Patch Tuesday.
If nothing, following up on some of these nightmares.
We do the show every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Stop by, say hi, watch live. It's everywhere on our website, twit.tv/live. YouTube has it, youtube.com/twit. Ustream, Twitch. We all have Twit channels. And then join the chat room, too, irc.twit.tv, because that's like the cool kids in the back. And there's a lot of, you don't watch the chat room. I know you've been in the chat room many times, but you don't watch it during the show. But there's always lots of stuff, comments. It's great. Research. If you can't watch live on-demand audio and video is always available at our site. And Steve's got audio and, uniquely, he's got human transcriptions of the show. Elaine Ferris does a great job. So you can go there and read along with Steve. And while you're there, pick up a copy of Spin Right. It wouldn't hurt you to give Steve a little money, support him. GRC.com. He's got a lot of free stuff there too. And then you wouldn't feel guilty using that and listening to the show, right? And we'll be back next week.
And you'll be able to get the pre-release of 6.1 mm-hmm. as it's coming along
mm-hmm.
before everybody else.
And is it coming along?
As soon as Squirrel's behind me, and we're making great progress on Squirrel.
Good. It's going to get that Squirrel back. If you're just tuning in, don't worry. Just hang out with us a little while. It'll all make sense.
Squirrel.
Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.
Security.